make better decisions from the information generated by precision farming technologies. So please help me in welcoming Dr. Terry Griffin.
Good morning. My throat's a little bit scratchy from this weather change. It's almost 80 degrees when I left home yesterday, and walk over here last night. I think I might have caught a cold. Well, it's good to be here, and I wanted to lead you down a path and get you thinking about a few things that you may or may not have thought about before, and maybe this will be a new way of looking at an old idea. Precision ag, what does precision ag mean to you? I think everybody would answer that question a different way. How many of you remember when we referred to agriculture or farming as mechanized farming and farming? What does that mean? What's the difference? It's okay if you want to go ahead and answer, throw that out there. Mechanized farming meant you use tractors instead of animal power. But eventually we stopped using the word mechanized because everybody was using tractors. We just called it farming. Let me pose this question to you. When are we going to quit saying precision in front of farming? Well, I don't know. I suspect eventually we will. Within the next 5 years, I doubt it, but eventually we will when everybody's using precision ag. And I'll show you a few examples of what I mean by that here in a moment. Precision ag has given us a lot of data. How many of you have got data for your farm or your client's farm? A lot of data. And how successful have you been in transferring that data into information to make farm management decisions? Yeah, everybody's in the same boat, okay? We all agree on that. There's lots of good hardware, lots of good software. Unfortunately, sometimes it's hard to get these things connected to each other, and there's been a lack of third-party support. A lot of folks have tried to do the analysis themselves, tried to find third-party support. But it's kind of interesting. It's one of those things where unless there's a lot of farmers who demand this service, qualified people will not form companies to provide this service. And until services exist, farmers are not going to demand the service and collect the data. Does that make sense? Sort of a chicken and egg type of issue. And as an economist, I've studied the increased yields, increased profits, reduced cost of precision ag, and I can show you several examples of those things happening, but it's not consistent across all studies. It's very inconclusive. It's seldom proven that the economics are beneficial. The adoption rates of precision ag technologies has been unprecedented when we talk about the automated equipment. When we talk about the adoption of data technologies, yield monitors, variable rate, these lag automated technologies, and I'm going to show a slide to back that up here in a minute. And I was talking to our host, who I think had to step out after he introduced me. He's been with his current employer case since 1998, so he's seen a lot of the things I'm going to discuss. This microphone's a little short. Can y'all hear me with my voice being scratchy? Okay. I can hear myself, but wasn't sure if you can. This triangle is something I want you to start thinking about. And I'm sure you've already considered this, but let's think about it. If you're a farmer or a crop consultant, you have a lot of intimate knowledge about maybe 5,000 acres, maybe 20,000 acres. A little magnifying glass there. You know a lot about that field or that set of fields. But as we move up to the county, to the crop reporting district, to the state, to the nation, to the world, you know less and less as a proportion of the whole system. What if you were able to combine resources with your maybe not direct competitors, your neighboring farmers or neighboring consultants, but people like you across the region to determine if there is opportunity to glean more information out of the precision ag data that you've been collecting? I want you to be thinking about that, and we'll get back to that towards the end of the presentation. I do not have a pointer up here. I guess I can use this blue line is light bar guidance. It was commercialized in about 1999, and it's served as the poster child for the adoption of precision ag. A very quick adoption curve. We went from being introduced in 1999 to breaking 80% about 7 years later, and it maxed 8 years later at about 85% of all service providers. These are not farmers, but service providers. The red line is automated guidance. Commercialized about 2004, has a similar, maybe even faster adoption at the service provider level. Last study year was 2011, and light bars and automated guidance were both about 70% of all ag retailers were using the technology. Let me ask you something. Why do you think light bar guidance has decreased in the last 4 years? It's been replaced by automated guidance. It's not as good as automated guidance. Let me ask you this. If we were Ag Connect in 2001, if there was one, I'm not sure, and if I asked, do you have a light bar on your farm or on your dealership or your company, and you said yes, would that have made you a precision farmer? Well, about in 2013? No. Not anymore. Goes back to the question, what's the difference between farming and precision farming? In 2013, I would argue that a light bar does not make a farmer a precision farmer. Automated guidance, I would argue it does. Let's compare this to that green line at the very top. This comes from USDA about total acres at the farm level, obviously, of biotech soybeans. They started collecting the data in the year 2000, and by that time, over half of all U.S. acres of soybeans were in biotech, herbicide resistant. And it kind of plateaued pretty quickly, right at 90%. That is probably the fastest adoption curve of any technology in agriculture. To give you an idea, for the history of corn hybrids, how long did it take for corn hybrids to reach a critical mass to plateau? If you look at the history, it's going to be best measured in decades. It took a long time. Biotech soybeans was, you know, essentially a few years. GPS guidance, especially automated guidance, has been the example in precision ag. What about yield monitors? When were they introduced into the industry? 1994 would be a good year to start talking about it. And GPS became available for civilians about that same year in 2001. It became a lot more accurate because selective availability was turned off. Where is GPS yield monitors on this curve for 2013? I'm not going to answer that because I'm sure I'll offend somebody no matter how I answer it. But it's going to be a lot lower than GPS guidance, a lot lower. Even if you consider every new combine, I don't know if this is exactly true, but most new combines rolling off the line will have a yield monitor on it, whether it's used or not. My litmus test is if it has a GPS unit and the data is being used by the farmer. If a farmer has automated guidance, I suspect they're using it. If they have a yield monitor, it's still uncertain whether they have. But anyway, the results I've seen from USDA suggest it's less than 30% of all acres. So it's very, very different. One of the questions we get a lot is the economics of precision ag. And I'll briefly talk about GPS guidance. Like all other economists, I did studies about if we reduce overlap and we increase in working rate of equipment, what's it worth to the farmer? And I can show you slides all day long about that, and I'll show you one quickly. But does it really matter? Think about it this way. If you go to a farm and you ask a farmer, what is GPS guidance worth to you? And, you know, it's not an economic thing measured in dollars. It's an economic thing measured in sociology. Family dynamics have been improved. Give you an example. In the 70s, we started having more and more cabs put on tractors. The dealers here, do you have farmers asking you, well, how much can I get that tractor for if I don't have a cab on it? Do they ever ask that question? Is that cab profitable technology for that farm? But they don't want to do without it. They're happier. Their families are happier with it. It's a quality of life issue. I would argue GPS guidance is in the same camp. It's a quality of life issue. There was a study that came, well, actually it wasn't a study, it was an interview by the Australian Broadcasting Company. If you get a chance to visit with the Australians about precision ag, I encourage you to do so. They're a very innovative group. Kendall Jackson was a reporter for Australian Broadcasting Company, and she did a interview with farm spouses about 10 years ago, in this case, farm wives. And they were talking about how more happy that they were due to GPS guidance because their husbands were less stressed at the end of the day. They actually got to spend quality time in the cab of the tractor or the combine or whatever, maybe even having lunch and so forth. The story goes on, and I'll just say that there were some examples of something analogous to the Mile High Club in aviation, but we'll move on from there. So information-intensive technologies, the ergonomics and economics have been less clear than for GPS guidance. The value of on-farm data is very hard to estimate. And I spent a lot of my career in the last 10, 15 years trying to get a handle on that. Most analyses have been done for a field at a time. Many of you, like me, have stared at a yield map on a screen for hours, maybe weeks on end, trying to determine what's going on in the field, trying to determine if one treatment did better than another, trying to determine if a drainage issue was impacting our yield. It occurred to me some time ago that this was not the right way of getting the most benefit from precision ag data. One field at a time is not going to cut it because there's not enough analysts in the world to look at every field or even the problem fields in a given year. But there is opportunity in the event that community analysis becomes a reality. This is the slide I promised to show you. I was comparing a 1 meter light bar against a 4 inch light bar compared to 4 inch automated guidance and 1 centimeter automated guidance, RTK. This just shows that the profitability is there if we able to depreciate the cost over several years. And these are comparing to no technology at all. But again, the economics doesn't really drive the sale of these things. I mean, do you agree with that as dealers? On our farm, I didn't have the privilege of farming in the time of GPS guidance. My dad and nephew still farm. But when I was farming, I was doing it the manual way, and I usually got yelled at because I'm a thinker, and I stop watching and start driving crooked. And my dad always says, you know, find a fence post and drive to it. And he'd come and stop me and says, I said fence post, not a cow. But I've had, you know, nephews who've never operated equipment that were used to playing video games could get on a tractor and operate it and do a good job of doing, you know, tillage work. The downside is we have a few older operators, I say older, yeah, most of them were, who couldn't leave the steering wheel alone. And you probably realize that as well. You've maybe have lost some labor pool with that technology, but you've gained a significant younger generation who could operate equipment very well. You know, those of us who are in this room need to think about things in terms of network effects. The classic example is the telephone. How many of you have a telephone? Everybody, right? You probably have one in your pocket. How valuable was that first telephone? Right, you couldn't call anybody. It had no value. When the second person got a telephone, it had value. As the third and fourth person got a telephone, everybody's value of that technology increased. Now that everybody has a telephone, huge value. In information technology and today in popular culture, think of Facebook. You know, it's pretty cool if it just stayed at Harvard, even with a half a dozen people. But when you have, I suspect a third of you or more are on Facebook, and if you're not, then your kids or your mother or grandmother is. So the more and more people who use it, the higher value it has. That's called a network effect or network externality. Well, you can extrapolate that to equipment and technology. Video rental stores were the example. If you had a community that had no VCRs, then there was no need to have video rental stores. Another way around, if there were no video rental stores, there was no reason to have VCRs. I guess we're dating ourselves, you know, DVDs, but I guess it's video rental stores, they don't even exist today. So without the third-party analyst or the third-party equipment support, I say third-party, it still could be the same dealership, but this is a new segment. It's not just providing equipment and a farmer. There's a third piece. It's going to be the service provider and or analyst. Until those exist, this circle is not complete. Therefore, there's a lot of opportunity on both sides. Let's talk about precision ag data and how it has been used. Many of you have done on-farm experiments. Can I see a show of hands, make sure everybody's still awake? You've all done on-farm experiments of some sort. This is a good example. This is a variety test. So it's genetic by environmental because the environmental comes in from different soils, different weather conditions. But I'm going to introduce a third one that you're familiar with already called management, okay? So in this particular field, the whole field is farmed with a uniform management. You've got probably a single planter that's on a constant row spacing throughout this whole experiment. Constant seeding depth, constant planting date. The management is constant throughout this whole system. The genetics are different, and you have different environments. Here's another example. This is a center pivot on corn. This is a seeding rate. Each of the colors represents a different seeding rate. At first glance, it looks like you have three, but you really have four if you consider the color of the whole field because we're looking at it as well. With our technology now, variable rate controllers, we can design these experiments on the computer, send them to the controller, and have people, the equipment operators, apply these without their knowing. I put a big emphasis on that. I spent 10 years in the Midwest, and there's a lot of differences in agriculture from the South to the Midwest. Typically in the Midwest, the farmer who was making the decision was on the tractor when these things were happening. In the South, the farmer who makes the decision may not, probably isn't the person on the tractor when these decisions are being or implemented. You may have people who are making minimum wage driving $200,000 equipment who may or may not be able to accurately read what's going on. So we want to make this as simple as possible. One of my pet peeves about 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, I was hearing precision ag is just a bunch of pretty maps. We've all heard that, right? Some of us may have even said it from time to time. Well, my goal is to dispel this saying. And the reason I say that is, you know, we as a society have sort of earned the reputation of precision ag as just a bunch of pretty maps because we get to the map and we stop. We may look at it, but we stop. Some of us may even put them on a frame and put them on a wall. And that's fine too, but we do not need to stop at the map. We need to keep going. So the prior examples of the field scale experiments I've shown need to be analyzed properly. And we've analyzed data in a number of ways. I suspect many of you have done research. If you've got a graduate degree, you probably have done some sort of research, so you're familiar with that. Agricultural research started about early 1900s. And the reason statistics exist is to negate the spatial variability within farms. If you're familiar with what happened in England at Rothamsted Experiment Station with Ron Fisher, he decided there was too much variation and he needed to negate that by randomizing the experiments, replicating the experiment. And this was a time that we didn't have computers, we didn't have advanced statistics. And in the mid-1900s, there was some progress in spatial statistics, but really in the last 30 years, those statistics have matured. How many of you are familiar with Guinness beer? Okay. And a lot of people do not know this, I found, but you know, being studying statistics, I've always been familiar with this idea. There was a person working for Guinness beer. His name was William Gossett. And he was doing experiments on barley to figure out what type of barley would best for the Guinness production. And he published some of his work, but Guinness did not want him to use his own name. So he used a pseudonym. He called himself Student. So if you're familiar with Student's Teed Test, that's William Gossett, who worked for Guinness, who was trying to make better beer. And so and that is, it's an agricultural experiment. So I wanted to throw that out to you. Agriculture has a really deep history in statistics. So when you first had a yield map, how did you analyze that data? You stared at it. You stared at it until it confessed, right? And one of the interesting things I've noticed, and this is researchers too, we're talking about university professors. You know, back in the late 90s, we would stare at the yield map, and we'd look at the averages, and thought, you know, that's not right. You know, that can't be right. So we'd start removing observations until we got the answer that we were expecting. And that's not research. That's going in with a with an agenda. And we didn't do it consciously, but that's one of the things we did do. But you're right. You know, the first thing we did, I call it eyeballing. We just eyeball the map. It's very subjective, very misleading. And this is where, you know, Precision Ag got the little slogan, just a bunch of pretty maps. That's where we stopped, with GIS as the ending point. Then we got more creative. We started taking averages by zones, by soils. And then we got a little bit more rigorous. We started applying the older techniques that were developed in the 1910s, 1920s, regression and analysis of variance, which, if you're familiar with statistics, the reasons we can use those techniques is because those observations were considered to be independent. With yield monitor data, the data is not independent, it's clustered. It negates all of the assumptions of classical statistics. And a lot of times I refer to this as mappy-matical. I see that term once in a while. You know, it's a map. We try to make mathematical assessments of it. And, you know, for instance, my doctoral work was on spatial statistics of yield monitor data. I was borrowing techniques from criminology, you know, housing values as a distance to police precincts, epidemiology, how diseases spread, geography, regional science, and ecology. Epidemiology is really fascinating when it comes to space. If you think about diseases that travel international borders, I mean, it's kind of obvious where they come from. You know, where do you think of diseases coming into the United States? Miami, Los Angeles, the major international airports. Well, the way that diseases spread, the techniques to analyze that are the same techniques we're using to analyze yield monitor data. And I'm going to try to prove a few points to you about why you should not stare at yield maps for hours on end. Do you see any black dots? I'm not sure if I can see them from up here. Can you see them? I mean, okay. Can you count them? I'm not even sure the origin of this graphic. I got on a, you know how you get a bunch of stuff emailed to you by people you might not even know? I got this about 15 years ago, and I thought I'd save it, and I'm glad I did because it makes a good point. Think about what you see and stare at the crosshair and try not to blink. And if you see something different, go ahead and share that with the rest of the group. Any of you see the green dot yet? And not the pink dots? Now, the next graphic is not animated. It's a still image. Do you see anything odd about this one? Well, where do you see the anomaly? Kind of hard to pinpoint it, right? You're seeing movement, but not where you're staring. Is that correct? It's kind of hard for me to see what you see from up here because it's a little bit different than on my screen. I did this one too, mainly just for fun. Now, this is a serious question for you, and I'd like to get some feedback. How many and what colors do you see? Well, just be thankful this isn't right after lunch. But, so what colors do you see up here? Red, green, blue? I'm going to give you a hint. There's three colors. The green that you see is this color, and the blue is actually the same color. And the reason that you see blue and green on this background of orange and pink, if you zoom in and kind of follow those orange lines down, you'll see that the green you see is circled or bordered by orange. And the blue is bordered by pink. That orange line turns into what you were calling blue. But there are three colors on the slide. So there's a point to those slides. One, you saw black dots where there were none, but you were trying to count them, and you were not successful. You eventually didn't see the pink dots that were there, but you did see a green dot that was not. The person sitting next to you at that time probably seen something very different than you did. So two people looking at the same image can not only get different interpretations, but their eye and their mind working together can send a different signal than your mind and eye working together. So the human mind and the human eye working together is very fascinating. The human brain picks up patterns where no patterns exist. That's what we do. We're people. We find patterns. If I asked you, and I'm not going to today, if I asked you to form a random pattern of people across this room, I'm pretty sure that we couldn't do it collectively. What we would do is form a uniform pattern across this room. Or a clustered pattern, we would have a hard time. It'd be unlikely for us to form a random pattern of people. I could give you a piece of paper, and I'd ask you to give me a random pattern of points. I'm pretty sure most of you wouldn't be able to do it. I've done that before, and done it in classrooms and presentations. We as people try to cluster things. We try to make things into a pattern. We see patterns where there are none. Looking up the if it ever clears up, we can look up at the sky and see clouds, and guess what? We see shapes, violins, elephants, something in the clouds. Those aren't there, but we see them. Now, those were some examples why you should not stare at yield maps to get a farm management decision. Those are some extreme viewpoint, extreme examples, but you know it's very real. Now I'm going to give you a few examples why you should not apply averages or traditional statistics to data that has a spatial pattern to it. Well, the question is, are these four colors the same or are they different? You've been tricked enough this morning where I'm sure you're afraid to answer. I will tell you that A and D are very different from one another. And B and C are very close to each other, but they're different than A and D. And that's easy enough when they're just sitting here next to each other. But in reality, whether it's a greenhouse or experimental design at the university or any other type of traditional small plot experiment, there's white noise. There's some random noise sitting on top of it. And the statistics are used to see through that white noise. But that's not farm scale. That's greenhouse scale. What if the noise was spatially correlated? This image is actually a rice field on our home farm. For those of you not familiar with rice fields, those light-colored lines are levees that hold water in those paddocks. Well, it's clear that you have a spatial cluster here, spatial noise on top of the colors. Now, even traditional statistics would not be able to help you determine if there's differences in those four colors. And those colors each represent some sort of treatment. You'll need to have advanced, state-of-the-art spatial statistical techniques to tell the difference. Okay. How do you use computers? I mean, every one of you have a computer in your pocket that has more power than the computer you used to keep records with in the 80s, and a whole lot cheaper. When we started using computers, this is kind of how we did it. We keeping records, we may have did some tax work, keep a record of herbicide, insecticide use. But along came precision ag. We put computers in our tractors, our combines, our cotton pickers. We carried them out in the field to collect data. Then we got more advanced. We started analyzing one field at a time. You've heard me hammer on that a little bit. Staring at a field. And I got to where I thought I had this nailed down pretty good and my process for analyzing one field at a time. So I invited some farmers and consultants and other folks to Purdue. After I finished my PhD, I went back and offered a few classes, had about three or four classes. And bless their hearts, everybody here intended to follow the process. But the problem is, everyone eventually came to something like this. It's overwhelming, it's frustrating. They didn't have time to deal with looking at a single field for 3 weeks at a time or even 1 week. And the lesson I learned was one field at a time wasn't cutting it for a lot of the work that we were doing. I do believe that we got to have high quality data at the field level. And we cannot just blindly throw in data into a system and call it good. It needs to be, locally verified by one or more people, the farmer, the consultant, and so forth. But staring at the data set for weeks on end just wasn't a good idea. And for the most part, we were talking about on-farm research. And that's one example of using precision ag data. Precision ag has caused a resurgence in on-farm research, and it's pretty obvious why. Yield monitors collect yield data without having to do a lot of measuring. variable rate controllers can implement the experiment without having to get out flags, without having to measure off plots. GPS guidance has made it easier. But we still face the problem of analyzing the data and decision making. Historically, analyzing the data was very time consuming, very expensive, and it still is. It still is. But one of the things I wanted to get you thinking about, going back to that triangle, what about community analysis, cohort analysis? If we imagine that that field represents less than 1% of all the fields in your geography, what if we start putting in together similar experiments, similar fields into a community pool of data and see if there's more information we can glean from the management? Because everybody has a different row spacing. Everybody has a different planting date. You get enough observations, then there are lots of opportunity. You know, in decision-making, trying to empower farmers, their advisors, and researchers to make the best decisions possible. Let me talk about big data for a second, because that's really what we're talking about right now. How many of you are familiar with big data? It's sort of the buzzword in a lot of business circles right now. If you've been to Walmart, Target, used a credit card, you're on the grid, okay? Usually I have a show of hands about how many people are on Facebook. So how many of you are on Facebook? All right, look around. Some of you are not, and the reasoning I've been told is I don't want to be on the grid. Well, if you've been to Target and used a credit card, you're on the grid. And Walmart makes decisions like, you know, should we put the salsa next to potato chips or do we put it in the Mexican food? And what level on the shelf? Bottom shelf, middle shelf, where we put it? It's not really an experiment, but they just have so many observations that they can do queries and get statistical results on where to place products. But your local mom-and-pop store cannot take advantage of this, even if they tried, because they do not have enough observations. Epidemiology, I mentioned it earlier. Big data, you know, when diseases break out, they're trying to figure out which ones are going to come. The flu shot, if you got a flu shot, there was a couple different strains of the flu that were in there, but not all of them. And they're using big data to figure out which ones are needed. Social networking is an example of big data. Google, number of clicks. Amazon, same way, browsing history. So what about ag? Well, historically, big data has been all about weather. University experiment stations are sort of a big data example. USDA data. But really, commodity trading and the weather data have been the poster childs for big data in agriculture. And now, precision ag data is going to be. How many pieces of data are in a file of yield monitor data for a given farm? So you have 50,000 data points. You have, and each of those data points gives you location, yield, moisture, elevation, ground speed. Maybe you have some engineering equipment information about fuel usage, RPM, a whole host of information. There can be literally a million data points for every given field that you have. But to me, that's not big data. One field at a time is not big data. It's going to be hundreds of thousands of acres to be big data. So what's up with my graphic? Many of you have probably heard the old story about an elephant walking into a village full of blind men. And each of the blind men, here they're blindfolded, they grab a different part of the elephant. And individually, they cannot determine what it is. One of them may say it's a tree. One of them may say it's your guess is as good as mine. But collectively, they put their information together, and they determine, hey, it's an elephant. Well, what if we treat precision ag data in the same way? We compare notes, And we're looking at the product, the environment, and the management that we talked about earlier. You know, yield is a function of the product, environment, and management. Someone once told me that a bag of seed has 100% yield potential until you open it. And it's the things that we do to it that reduces the yield. It's the management that we apply to that acre. It's the environmental situation that we put that seed in, and also the environmental situation that occurs that we may not have been aware of. It's not just about the product. It's about all three. The management, you know, I mentioned a few things earlier. Fertility levels, irrigation, IPM issues. How exactly does your technology interact with that management? Can we identify water issues? Fertility, seeding. Requires a whole lot of observations. One field at a time is not going to cut it. This is a screenshot from one of the tools that we have. And you know, essentially, if you have hundreds of thousands of acres in a community, you can get, you know, this is sort of a report card. We're calling it a mesel bench, a benchmarking tool. You know, this particular farmer may have had, get my pointer back out. It's kind of hard to see, but these are percentiles. And corn, very low percentile based on yield against their neighbors. And not a very good corn producer, but above average cotton producer. Now, what attributes of a farmer makes them a top 10% or a top third farmer? What management decisions can I make to improve the probability that I'm in that top 10%? Another tool, we're calling this Mesoplan. This is a tool that takes the community data, looks at the product, the environment, the management, and how those products perform against each other, trying to find the bundle of varieties that minimize risk for a given yield level. This is another example of how big data can be used in agriculture from data from Precision Ag. Now, I didn't stress it yet, but I think it's important to say that we're not just talking about yield data. Yield data by itself is great. I've had farmers bring me hard drives full of data that may have had 5,000 acres for the last 10 years, but all it was yield data. So all I knew was the yield, the date it was harvested, the moisture. I didn't know the planting date. I didn't know the product or the variety planted. I did not know what applications were made to that field. I did not know if it was irrigated or not irrigated. So we're talking about data. We're not just talking about the data that comes from the combine or the cotton picker. There's all these other layers of data that are necessary in order to be valuable. Where do I see the future of precision agriculture going? Well, I firmly believe that data from a single farm has finite value if kept at that farm level. The greatest value for that data occurs when it's used in a community analysis. The greatest value to that particular farmer is greatest when that data is used in community analysis. What do we need? We need more supporting information, metadata, like I just mentioned, the planting date, the cultivars, applications, weather. We need third-party support for software and technology and analytics at the farm level in order for the precision ag industry to move forward. I suspect there may be some engineers here, since this is Ag Connect and ASABE is here. Development of additional sensors that provide dense information, soil properties, microclimate, imagery. Yield data is great. It's pretty high density, but it's one layer. More layers will make the system more valuable. And USDA has a three-year initiative to solve this last problem, but it's a huge problem when we talk about community data. If you farm only in one county, you have not really seen this issue. But if you farm at county borders or multiple counties, that same soil may have two different names. It may be potentially two different textures. I mean, sometimes it's really far off depending on who did the mapping. So the soil mapping units at political boundaries are being corrected by USDA. They have a three-year timeline. I'm hoping it's sooner than later. So that's the presentation I had for today. Here's my contact information and our mission statement for our company. I'd like to open up to any questions if there are any. The question had to do with how do we prevent taking an average of an average when we have fields with all these different data layers. That's a good question. The systems shouldn't be just field average for themselves. They need to be subfield areas. Because even the fields we consider relatively homogeneous, in reality are not. So subfield areas should be entered into the database as, if you want to call them, individual fields. Does that make sense? Or is that, did I miss the point? Okay. So it may rain on one half of the field, not on the other half of the field, causing pretty big yield differences. It could be as simple as deer walking through the middle of the field, just stripping plants or something. With traditional statistics, that would be magic to be able to account for that with an unknown. But with modern spatial statistical techniques, what it's able to do, if you're familiar with statistics, it looks at what's left over that's not explained, and it corrects for the unexplained portion. Again, it doesn't do magic. In extreme cases, it's not going to be able to do anything. But if it is something like elevation over a field that works in a smooth pattern, then those types of variations can be explicitly accounted for with a spatial statistical model. If it, let's say you're doing an on-farm experiment, the west half of the field is one cultivar, the east half is another cultivar, it rains on the west half, not on the east half, I do not see a way of getting any sort of accurate measurement from that system. You had a question here in front. Us. Good question. Our model is not set up that way. Our model is to empower the consultant, the local retailer, and so the farmer would have a personal relationship with their consultant, their advisor, whoever it may be, and it's that person who would work with them to, you know, if they participate with us, they would be our client, the consultant, the ag retailer. Adjacent farmers' data depends on what part of the country you're in. Some people are very sensitive to their neighbors benefiting at all, right? So those issues have been thought of. You know, it could be thought of as people in your geography who are not immediate competitors. You know, there's different ways of weighting who's in and who's not in your community. So is that the, mm. Right. Well, our viewpoint is the data's got to be protected with. Oh, sorry. The question had to do with. Some farmers would not want their immediate neighbors to directly benefit from their information. That's a very reasonable question. What I would suggest, in the way our model is set up, is that that farmer's advisor would be the person who would sign off on that information saying that data is good. It's got to be quality data. We just can't throw in raw yield monitor data into the system and say, hey, here it is. But the data is individually exist in our system in aggregate form such that it has a similar, you know, medical records, you know, for it's called HIPAA standards. It's the same level of security as the medical profession would use so that no other person can get access to it. And if you did a query of the system, there's safeguards in place for sample size and other things where there's no possible way for you to determine how any other individual or small group of individuals are performing, because that's very important and that's got to be safeguarded. Yes, sir. The question was, is it a reach for the government to be interested in the database from a regulatory standpoint? What do you think? My approach to environmental issues has always been that we need, as a society in agriculture, we need to be proactive in showing that we are good stewards of the land. We are not misusing inputs. We are not. I think there's capability for those type of issues to be addressed from a proactive standpoint. I do not want to suggest that it be a reactive or a reporting system for compliance, which I would be strongly against. Yeah.
Can you speak to your thoughts on the use of some of these new or some that have a lot of cloud-based systems to transfer and manage data for the individual?
The question was about cloud-based systems that can wirelessly transmit data. The way I interpreted that, from the machine to the server, I love the idea. I love the idea. And when I was at the university, it's amazing how many PhDs cannot get a combine card from the combine to the computer without losing it. Okay? So we need to take that step completely out of the system. That's a weak link. Long term, yes, everything's going to be wireless. I do not have an answer for you about how, whether it's going to be cellular or Bluetooth, or if the combine is going to transmit the data to the fuel tank every day, which transmits it to the fuel transport holder. And there's different ideas on how this could work. I do not know how it will, but I do know that it needs to work in order for everything else to be in place. Yes, sir. The soil types, I've got some maps I found that they didn't even give a name. They just gave a texture. And I'm not even sure those were correct. Different, wasn't the same person who mapped the whole United States. It was a bunch of different people. And some individuals were better at it than others. And therefore, some areas have better maps than others. It was never intended, we all know, it was never intended to do what we're doing with it. But we all use it, and we're all going to continue to use it until there's a source of data that's better. Field by field, we can go in and collect electrical conductivity. We can collect, you know, real color of the soil, whatever. But if we're looking at large geographies, we're going to go to the least common denominator, which is Sergo. Sergo is getting better. NRCS out of Lincoln, Nebraska, has some initiatives underway to improve. They're going to take the soil mapping units and break them down to production classes, and those will be comparable across territories. They've been saying that for a little while, and I went to the Tri-Societies meeting, the American Society of Agronomy, Soil Science Society, and Crop Science Society in October, and that was the underlying theme, was we need to revisit these soil mapping units. And it's not the old taxonomists, or they were what, podologists. They weren't the podologists who were doing the work a long time ago. These are people in their 30s who were wanting to take a new look at old data and see if we can make it work for precision ag. So the hope is there. Yes, sir. According to the adoption statistics, a yield monitor is placed most people start. But I am not saying that's where you should start. A lot of people would suggest, like you did, and it's piecewise, one thing at a time. A few people have done it, both feet, jump in. Good question. So I'm going to turn that over to the crowd, get a response. The question is, how should we start in precision farming? Should we start with automated guidance, with the yield monitor, the whole nine yards? I've heard three people say three different things. Now, swath controls, economic payback, year one. Yield monitor, it's data. It has no value until you make information out of it. The reason I said yield monitor, and I suspect the reason someone else did, was because your first year of yield monitor data collection may not be your best one. And there's some things you can learn that first year that by the time you are ready to use it, you've gotten those human error and machinery errors worked out. There's a lot of things that can be gleaned from that. I suspect what you said was compare the yield monitor data to what's actually get hauled in with the warehouse scales. The thing warehouse scales does not tell you is where your highs and lows are. You know where your highs and lows are, but you may not realize how high or how low that they were. And that's where the yield monitor will give you a good anecdotal evidence of what you should scout for. I agree with that. But there are no wrong answers to that question, I don't think. Yes, sir. So you had yield monitors in the early 90s. There were no variable rate GPS-guided prescriptions. Yes. So the yield monitor gives us a point of reference for going forward. Can you do it with infrared mapping? NDVI from aerial, satellite, ground-based? I'm not going to answer that directly. Can you use remote sense imagery to determine yields? Hard to know. Any other thoughts?
Depends how closely you're related to biomass. A lot of times it's catch
It depends on how closely yield is related to mild mass. That's right. So I suspected people who says it's a good idea are corn farmers. Cotton farmer, that doesn't work that way. It's not direct relationship bowel mass to yield. So it's going to depend on a few things. It depends on the crop. It depends on when that imagery is taken and a few other things. There have been some good studies that had got pretty good correlation from yield and imagery for some crops, cereal grains mostly. Oh, I haven't looked this way. Hey. The question would be, how do we get enough farmers to participate in order to have a critical mass in order for this thing to work? I need you to sign up. That's a very good question. It is these tools are very data hungry. And I think what Don was referring to is, we've had this discussion before, you know, direct competitors in the farming industry, especially in the Midwest, you know, farmers said, I do not want my neighbors benefiting from anything I do. And part of that is for the reason from the fierce competition for farmland. We got to decide which is more important, being able to take advantage of what we have through a community analysis or not taking advantage of what we have just so someone else would not be able to take advantage of it either. Everybody needs to play ball in order for this system to work, well. That. I'll turn it back to y'all. How am I going to get everybody in this room to do it? The question had to do with how to address the fact that there are so many different standards of data and different ways of storing data at the farm level, different software. Every equipment manufacturer has their proprietary way of storing and managing those data files. You mentioned that it's been, 10 years since we've been discussing this idea, and I've been in lots of discussions with, you know, Ag Gateway last however many years they've been working on that idea. There's other smaller groups who've been trying to collectively work across the industry to make that happen. I do not personally have an answer for that, but it has to be standardized. And right now, all of our clients are on a single standard system. But that's not to say that everybody's going to have to follow that same standard. You know, it may be up to us to figure out how to connect that node and that translation of that when we, you know, start looking at other geographies or other clients. But I do not directly have an answer for you how to do that. I'm sure that probably a third of the people in this room have strong feelings on how that's going to happen, but I do not have one. Matt. what constitutes a statistically significant sample size given the variability on soils, yields? Well, it's not the old answer of 30, okay? I cannot give you an answer, but it's going to be thousands and thousands of data points. If you think about, like, gasoline prices, okay? It's not an experiment. It's observational data. But if we follow gasoline prices monthly for the last 30 years, we can do some analyses, correct? It's the same idea. I mean, it's lots of data, but, you know, the idea of 30 independent data points does not hold here. We're looking at thousands and thousands. The reason I'm answering that in a vague sense is that I do not have a precise answer, and I do not believe that a precise answer exists. It's going to depend upon a lot of different factors. Mike. The question was, this gentleman's group houses the data for his consulting clients. And the question was, if they handed over all the data to us, would that be enough to run? Roughly 100,000 acres. Well, if we had one big field of a 100,000 acre field, no. If we have 100,000 acre fields, no. If you have 1,100 acre fields, probably. So looking at roughly 2,000 fields of about 50 acres each, and we may be able to subdivide those down into smaller units per field, then yes, that would be, you know, anything north of 1,000 observations, I have not seen not work. But more the better. Yes, sir. So the comment was with equipment and other providers, data's being shared, and the question would be, shouldn't we get something back from them as part of the agreement? Was that a question or a... Okay. It's a two-way access to information, or you're saying, not one way. Yes, sir. I would agree. The comment was precision ag is more than just equipment and the technology from the equipment. It's us trying to make better decisions. And yes, and that's really no different than the way we farmed 100 years ago. We just didn't have the technology or the equipment. We were still trying to have more information, and we spent time in the field. You know, farmers stepped on every square foot of that field every year. And they had an intimate knowledge of that field that we do not have today, and therefore we've kind of replaced that with equipment. Precision ag tools are just tools to allow us to do precision ag. Is that...
Improperly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think everybody could probably hear this gentleman speak. Maybe. Okay, you would disagree. Yes, sir. Over here. We could start a. We're going to have a panel discussion now. That goes back to that network effect slide I've shown. We get the farmer, we have the data. Until we get the analyst in that circle, then it's not going to be complete. It's got to have all three in order for that to happen. Yes, sir. The comment had to do with return on investment. You know, we all use CPAs to do our taxes. We don't do them ourselves because they're a lot better at it than we are, and we don't want to do it. So we outsource that to a third party. Has a much higher return on investment. With that being said, he was saying that we need to approach our service providers and agronomists and tell them what we as farmers would like to have and what we need and what we want. I would encourage all of you to do the same thing and, you know, put the buzz in our ears about what it is that you really want. And, you know, that's like one of my slides I put up. I was encouraging engineers to work on the development of sensors. I want you to do the same thing with that, too, you know, because they'll listen if enough people, you know, start speaking up about those things. So the comment was, you know, the equipment companies are gathering information regardless of what color the equipment is. And the gentleman was saying, you know, as long as they provided quality information back that they could make profitable decisions with, then they're more likely to buy another tractor from that same company or same color company. And that's where the real value is going to come to this idea.
I tag along with that. I think as the GPS sensor comment,
Now, the question had to do with, you know, start looking at machinery logistics and can we determine, well, maybe I don't need the second combine. I think you were asking if software exists. You didn't go to Purdue, did you? The reason I say that is until about 3 years ago, Purdue had this opportunity for farmers to put their data into a system. They called it, the last version was called B21. How many of you went to Purdue and worked at Top Farmer Workshop? You know what I'm talking about, that LP model? It did essentially the same thing as what you described. It's a machinery model. And it tells you stuff like, well, if I go from a 12-row to a 16-row planter, this is how my farm would be affected. You know, these are the overall profitability I should have increased or decreased or whichever way it moved. And the second combine is worth so much to me. You know, but they ceased using it, I think, 3 years ago. And I think that model is used for almost 40 years in some form or fashion. But software does exist to do those things. Well, here's my contact information. I'll be around till tomorrow afternoon. I am glad I'm here. I almost did not make it. My wife had almost had surgery yesterday and decided not to, and so I'm here. And I plan on being here till tomorrow afternoon unless doctor says otherwise. So if you want to catch up with me, I should be around the rest of the afternoon and most of tomorrow.